Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamata Satavara Yesodavanta Bamunjantu Sadam. Now this is the full moon, February, in the Magga Puja. Okay, so I thought I'd read the write-up on this day. So the Magga Puja Day is the annual celebration of the Buddhists held in the full moon day of the third lunar month, which is February. In Thailand, the ceremony of Magga Puja is performed to emphasize the significance of the Magga month. It was the period in which the Buddha constituted the main code of his instructions and which is universally regarded as the heart of Buddhist teachings. The historical events preceding this period must be reviewed briefly. The Buddha delivered his first discourse to the five ascetics, namely Anya Kondanya, Vapa, Padiya, Mahanama, and Asaji, who when they heard the enlightened one, were ordained, becoming the five noble disciples. The Buddha then made a retreat at Isipatana in the deer park near Benares, and there he ordained Yasa, the son of an influential family, who had approached the Buddha and had received instructions on the discourse concerning the fivefold principles, namely generosity, morality, happy life, renunciation, and the benefit of ordination. He took at his refuge the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Thus he entered into the monastic life, and the order now increased to 60 in number. The Buddha urged the monks to journey in different directions and places to disseminate the law of the truth. Hence, the first Buddhist missions began. The teaching of the Awakened One was since spread to many people in many lands. The Buddha himself went to preach at Rajagaha, the capital of the Magadha state, and there three ascetics, regarded as great teachers, became Buddhist monks together with their disciples, and the reported number then being 1,000. Bimbisara, the king of that state, became a Buddhist, taking the triple gem as his spiritual guide and supporting the Buddhist mission. The king gave, as a residence for the Buddha and his order, a quiet and suitable place called Weluwana Vihara, the bamboo grove. And this was the first Buddhist temple. Here many thousands of the citizens became Buddhists. During the period when the Buddha was staying in the Weluwana Vihara, a certain incident took place on the full moon day of the third lunar month. The bhikkhus, about 1,250 in number, who had been ordained by the Buddha himself and since then engaged in missionary activities, returned without prior notice to the great teacher to question him further about his teaching. This took place at the great assembly of all the holy ones at Weluwana Vihara, where the Buddha delivered the discourse on the main code of his teaching, which can be summarized thus. Patience, this is to say forbearance, is considered the supreme endeavor. All the Buddhists speak of Nibbana as the highest goal. A bhikkhu who still does harm and violence to others is not a recluse at all. Do no evil, do whatever is good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas, non-abuse, harmlessness, restraint through the disciplinary code. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So that's known as the Owada Patimokkha. So in this particular writing, they didn't say any of them were arahants. They said they were bhikkhus. That makes it easier. So this is the like this is the tradition, and that's where this. In any tradition, you have it can easily become a perfunctory kind of blind obedience or just unquestioning following, or one can rebel against tradition or have these opinions about their value or the problems they cause, or whatever. Because on the conventional level, remember, the conditioned realm is the way it is. It's not perfect. So you can't find a perfect tradition or system or convention because that's just not the way it is. Perfection is not something that you find in the conditioned realm. The perfection of the conditioned realm is that its nature is imperfect. So that in this way you begin to not demand or expect perfection from what is by its very nature imperfect. But this advice of refrain from doing evil, do good, purify the mind. That's very simple, isn't it? I suppose if I would like to think if there's 1,250 arahants, what would a Buddha have to say to those to arahants? You know, just why would you have to say anything? and so you say what is most simple, you know, there's a simple do good, refrain from doing evil, purify the mind. So this refrain from doing evil, and this is something to, you know, that we all respect to take on this, like this, the eight precepts, the anagarikas, taking on these are precepts to remind us to refrain from doing harmful acts, either through action or speech. So we can see it as taking on responsibility for how we live. And I found this, the sila as a basis, very important because, this is how you do develop, self-respect. A sense of your self-worth in terms of how you live your life, you know, your intentions, and what how you intend to use your physical body and your mind in the society. So, like choosing to live in the way of the sila. The five precepts, the eight precepts, the ten, or the vinaya training type of thing is just learning to examine experience. Simplification, ways of remembering, of bringing back into our consciousness what our intentions are. So you notice I was reading in the Guardian about the in Rwanda, these children that were trained, that were involved in the slaughter 6-7 years ago. You know, young children that were involved in the slaughter of the Tutsis, the in the genocide in Rwanda, and trying to reintegrate these, to get them to deal with the psychological problems that are involved with having been involved in acts of violence, murder and torture and whatnot. So it's it's for us it's rather shocking to even hear of such kind of behavior, but yet you can see with children also they're like if they haven't had they're pretty much be conditioned the way whatever you want to put into them that's what they'll receive. So through various kinds of social pressure, rewards and punishment, you can kind of manipulate people's minds and get them to participate in unwholesome activities, things that create endless problems for themselves and others in this, on this planet, in this world, in this society. So in terms of sila, on the Buddhist sense, the awakened mind, isn't it? Sila, in terms of as Buddhism regards it, is you have to request it. It's not an imperative, not a commandment. Nobody says you have to keep the sila or that you're going to be punished if you don't. Because the whole attitude of the Buddha is awakening, to awake up and to reflect, to notice and to take responsibility for how you live your life. So then, of course, in terms of self-respect, this I found gave me an attitude of respecting myself. I found living life just on terms of pleasure-seeking, hedonism, I found I couldn't respect myself for just following just the way of just seeking happiness and pleasure, even though in many ways it was fun and exciting, at the end of the day, I lost respect for myself. Because when I just in my own way of thinking or looking at life, I respect this kind of non-violence, harmlessness. I long to be responsible for myself for how I live. I don't respect people who blame others for their problems and blame the society and blame the parents and blame the government and blame God and that. And even though I'm certainly quite capable of producing thoughts along that line, I don't respect that in myself or in others. Because I know, that I am responsible. I take on the responsibility. And I feel this gives me this, what I might consider self-respect. In terms of dana sila bhavana, generosity, willing to share and to be generous and kind and that with the other people that one lives with in the society that one is in. So dana sila and then bhavana or meditation. Cultivation. When we come to cultivation or bhavana, this word bhavana is used in the Fourth Noble Truth as an insight. And they usually translate it as development or cultivation. So to me, this is the way of mindfulness. So to me, bhavana is very direct, very simple. And the Eightfold Path then kind of comes together in the simple experience of mindfulness. Through just attention to the moment, through awareness. And reflecting, being able to really observe the way it is. And so the Vipassana teachings are pointers to the way it is, but if you grasp the Vipassana teachings as an end in themselves, you won't see the way it is either. You know, this is the danger of methods, of traditions, of teachings, is that we tend to grasp the teaching rather than use the teaching for awakening. Or like the finger pointing at the moon, isn't it? We end up looking at the finger, never looking at the moon, never seeing what it's pointing at. So the awakening, somebody says, Ajahn Sumedho says, Buddhism is about awakening. And then they can quote me, or they can quote anyone, you know, Dalai Lama, or gives authority to what you say. And you can get all kinds of, you know, in dictionaries and in books and so forth, all kinds of good ideas about what Buddhism is about. But awakening is very simple, isn't it? It's not asking the impossible. What is awakening? Because I can't speak for you, I can speak only from my own experience. So the Buddha, the word Buddha means the awakened one. So I think I'm awake. My eyes are open, and what does it mean to be awake? Because I'm awake, but I'm not enlightened, and I'm still, I still get angry, and I still have all kinds of problems, and so forth, and so, I'm awake, but I don't see where what does it mean? And so we think we're awake because our eyes are open, but we're lost in that, in the conditions of the self-view, aren't we? There's a doubting, who is awake? Am I awake? What does it mean? I'm not enlightened. I still have problems. I've got to do something in order to become something. So we grasp the idea of awakeness. So obviously grasping the idea of awakeness is not being awake, is it? Or knowing all about Buddhism doesn't mean that you're awake. Being a Buddhist scholar or whatever, even practicing meditation. Some of the most unawakened people practice meditation. And then they do it with the idea of trying to awake. So some people spend years sitting on a zafu, sitting on their asanas, and never wake up. What can you do? So obviously it isn't just, grasping techniques or traditions or teachings, no matter how good and wise these might be, or skillful, or marvelous, or inspiring, or whatever, we recognize that awakening isn't grasping the ideas of Buddhism, but it's the simple imminent act of paying attention. And so when I realized this, when it's really sunk in, it made all the difference Because I can certainly could inspire myself. I found Buddhism inspiring. You know, when I first discovered Zen Buddhism, when I was in the Navy, I was just get high as a kite just reading D.T. Suzuki or Alan Watts. I'd get kind of just really high. I remember going out to Golden Gate Park in San Francisco and spending the afternoon just sitting under a tree reading D.T. Suzuki and getting inspired and just wanting to get more books and read more, and I get more inspiration. So by grasping inspired teachings, you know, you become inspired. But then that doesn't last. You can't, you know, that is like a starting thing that kind of gets you going. But inspiration depends, I mean, you have to keep a kind of, what inspires you today will not inspire you tomorrow. So you have to keep looking for new sources, new teachers, new methods, new this, that, something that will keep this level of inspiration going. But in the end of the day, it collapses. Inspiration will let you down. And so, but hopefully inspiration will put you, you know, point to the right direction. So it did, you know, this idea of mindfulness, meditation. Now in the monastic life, I remember being very inspired by the bhikkhu life and the forest tradition in Thailand. And yet, after a while, the inspiration was gone. And then I just began to be critical of the whole thing. It was to, you know, in the rainy season at Wat Pa Pong, it gets so depressing. Because in the monsoons in Thailand, it gets so damp and wet and everything stinks. And you're sitting next to these monks and they're in stinking robes. and everything looks dreary and then you don't see anybody, you know, you just see, you know, you, it just looks so, and your critical mind takes over. So the monks you thought at one time were highly evolved, you begin to see they're nowhere. You go from one extreme to the other. They're highly attained, and then you realize that you think, oh, they're nowhere. But then the teaching is one of awakening. So awakening is the ability to just notice, like inspiration is like this, or boredom, aversion, anger, resentment is like this. Being unsure, being uncertain, being caught up in your own self-view is like this. Being attached to ideas, ideals, or institutions, or traditions is like this. And so this is the awakened mind. It's not taking position for or against, but noticing the way it is, what attachment to conditions is as experience. So whether the conditions are traditions or ideals or ideas or institutions or teachers or individuals or whatever, that's not the point. The attachment, the upadana, we're awakening to the suffering that we create through upadana, or clinging, identification, or attachment. So this is bhavana, or developing the Eightfold Path, or the middle way, Majjhima Patibhatta. As you begin to really appreciate this awakened awareness, attention, this sense of investigation, of going to the root of the problem, of you know, every day we chant santitiko akaliko ehi pasko opanaiko bhajitang meti dapo inu, and these are the Dhamma, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading onwards to be experienced individually by the wise. So that means that you know, this is grasping now, the words of the Dhamma is not it, is it? Or being able to chant that, you can chant that and still, you know, not be awake. But in awakening, be paying attention. So that you're looking inward. But actually, looking inward outward doesn't make sense. But at first, this sense of looking inward helps, because our conditioned mind tends to be very much identified with externals. We're aware of, you know, we're so fascinated or interested or whatever by the things that pass in front of us. But say in meditation, sitting on the zafu, we can be awake or not. But if we're awake, then we're aware of just the simple things, simple, ordinary things like sitting, is like this, breathing, or just we're aware of the sensations that we're experiencing through the body, or the state of mind. We're aware of this kind of mental mood or emotional state that we happen to be experiencing at this moment. It's like this. So we're aware of the mental or the physical, emotional, pleasure, pain, neutral. And to pay attention is awakenness, sati sampajanya. Because we can sit and completely ignore the body and the mental state. You know, we've got an agenda, maybe. You know, I've got to get my samadhi. This is meditation time, so I'm going to come in here and I'm going to sit down. And then we've got this idea that we've got to do something. We've got a technique. We've got to get something that we don't have. We've got to get rid of our defilements. We've attached to a lot of ideas and teachings and techniques. And so when we do what we call meditation, we're not doing it through awakeness, but through attachment to the ideas we have. So then even words like meditation or can become things that keep us asleep. Even though we might try hard to practice awakening, we attach to the idea rather than being awake. So, like in, when we're using this awakenedness as our means, then we can we're aware of the things that we're attached to, the feeling that we should practice or that we've got to get our samadhi. We're aware of these as maybe attitudes of mind that we're very attached to, that we're very influenced by. We can be aware of even the despair or the feeling of failure or the feeling of inadequacy or feeling of I'm not enlightened as a condition. So that actually in this awareness, in this awakenedness, then the conditioned realm that we're experiencing is seen in terms of what it is. And what is it? You know, in terms of experience now, when you really switch on the light and observe, is it all thoughts and feelings, pleasurable, painful, neutral, physical, mental, emotional, are, you know, they are what they are in the present. So there's a recognition of the suchness of something. It is what it is right now, but you can't sustain it, can you? Conditioned phenomena is changing, and a relentless, inexorable change. So you're aware of the changingness of it. So with Satipanya, you're observing the way it is. It is what it is. So you're not trying to say it's something it's not. Not kind of trying to make out that something is something else. So in this word suchness or as-isness, whatever you're feeling right now is what it is, like this. But as you accept the way it is, you're aware that you can't keep it the way it is. It's not going to stay that way. It changes. So the awareness is of change, of anicca. All conditions are impermanent. So this is encouraging this trusting in this awakenedness. This awareness, because it's something that you can't make somebody do. And so it's like I remember, if I keep saying, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, and very soon you just have an aversion to me and Buddhism and so that Ajahn Sumedho is always on my back telling me to wake up. And then so even though I might have very good intentions, you know, really, your welfare is foremost in my mind all the time. And yet you refuse to wake up. You just get averse to me. And you're not aware of it. You think. But if you wake up and realize the version of Ajahn Sumedho is like this, then I've succeeded. But you have to do that yourself, don't you? I mean, I can't make you do that. So this is like when we say, bhajjatang vaitidapo vinyui, to be experienced individually. You have to know. And this knowing is you have to trust. So this is where, like in the beginning of this winter's retreat, the emphasis I started out with in the formal retreat, the reflections in the morning around the first three fetters, the sakkaya, ditti, the personality view, as to explore personality and get to the source where there's no personality before personality arises. So that's to be in the place to be here and now is before you become a person. And then just learning to recognize. I mean, if you just assume you're the same person all the time, then and never question it, then you'll spend the rest of your life always with the same delusion, and never notice the way it is. But so I was saying meditation, then with awareness, sati sampajanya, it's like switching on the light, like a big floodlight, so that that which is aware, the awareness, is not a personal thing, is it? Has no personal quality. It's light, it sees, it's consciousness. And then what comes into that is the personality will arise and cease. And though the personality is a sense of me and mine and what I should and shouldn't be and all this kind of thing. And so Sakyaditi is seen in terms of with awareness, with sati and panya. So panya is wisdom. Wisdom is something that's natural to this awakened consciousness. It's not a personal attainment. It's not like a personal ability. You know, like you might think have more wisdom than you do. You know, you might think, Ajahn Sumedho, he has more wisdom than I have. Or you might think, you have more wisdom than I have. But the wisdom, in terms of panya, is not something in amount. It's not like mine. It's not a personal acquisition that I have. You know, because I've been a monk for so long, I've got kind of oodles of it, a lot more than you have. But that's not the way it is. Panya is natural to us. When we awaken, then there's wisdom. Wisdom isn't something that you don't have. It's something you may not use or recognize. So like attachment to the personality view means that then wisdom can't operate. It doesn't mean you don't have wisdom. It means you're attaching yourself to ignorance. Your identity is with ignorance. So as long as your identity is with ignorance, then no matter how hard you try, you end up with ignorance as a result. So, you know, you can't use wisdom through being ignorant. So the awakened awareness is like switching on the light, being aware, away, where wisdom then can function. But wisdom then isn't personal. Not like I'm wise or I have a lot of wisdom. And when I start claiming it, then it goes back into ignorance. It goes back into Sakyaditi again. When I start claiming it as my personal achievement, then I'm back in the Sakyaditi or personality view. So it's not a matter of identity or claiming, but in trusting in awareness. Like trusting in awareness doesn't seem like much. You know, so it's easily kind of regarded or dismissed or even ignored or not even recognized as being of anything worth doing, because you're still committed to yourself as a person, as your reality. So this is why I keep pointing to this basic problem. Just listen to yourself. Wake up to your personality, what you think you are, you're not. So the sentence, I am an unenlightened person, and I need to practice meditation in order to become enlightened. And listening to that, and then intentionally thinking that, and listening to myself thinking it, then there is an awareness of the thought, of it as thought, of that I'm creating. I'm producing this thinking, deliberately choosing to think this sentence, but that which is aware is what I'm really interested in, being the awareness rather than believing in the sentence as being a true statement of my state of being. So you begin to see the difference, recognize the difference between the awakened consciousness and the conditioned self views that that one generally holds to and identifies with. So it is simple enough. You can forget all about these ideas of getting samadhi and having to get this kind of samadhi before you can do that, and the endless kind of instructions that Buddhist meditation gives us. It's better to just see that in terms of whether you know how it affects your mind. You don't have to deny it or think there's anything wrong with it, but it's more useful to see how you get intimidated by, you get a very strong teacher coming here somebody's going to come here and say, oh, Arjuna's made us got it all wrong. You have to do it this way. And then if you haven't explored Sakyaditi and Siddhabhata Paramasa and Vichikicca or doubt, then, oh God, maybe he's wrong, But as soon as you switch on the light, you're aware of being confused or doubt-ridden. That you can know, that's a direct knowing. Whether I'm right or wrong, you don't know, maybe I'm wrong. But all you need to know is that it's like this for you. You don't know, or confusion, or this. That's all you need to know. That the condition, whatever is present, is the way it is. And you're accepting. You're not trying to do anything with it, but just recognize it in terms of a Dhamma. And then you see it's changing. This is a direct knowing. This you can know for sure. It is the way it is. It's like this. And therefore, this is, in the Kalama Sutta, where the Kalamas were very upset and confused because various teachers would come through, and each one would claim their version was the right one and all the others were wrong, or their method or their technique was the best and the others were lesser. So the Kalama said to them, what are we supposed to believe? This Ajahn comes and he says this, and then the next day another Ajahn or Guru comes and then he'll say something else, just the reverse, and I don't know what to believe. How are we supposed to know? And then the Buddha gives these nine, things not to believe in terms of hearsay, or in terms of, whether it's tradition, or whether it's from a great monk, or whether from the scriptures. He says, you don't believe in the script, don't believe just because the scriptures say so, or believe because the great Ajahn says so, or believe because everybody thinks so, or everybody all agrees that it's true, and we still don't. And it says you know through the direct realization. So this is kind of amazing sutta, actually. So I think it's the only religion, Buddhism, that produces such a script, which allows you to kind of doubt even the basis. In most religions you're expected to never doubt the scripture. Or, in some of the priest or the authority, the priesthood you're supposed to believe in and never question, or the sacred scripture, that's infallible. But then when you put it in terms like of this direct knowing, what can you know now? in terms of, you know, what is true, what is real right now. And whatever you're feeling, you can know that is a condition that is present. You know, it is the way it is. So if it's confusion or doubt or happiness or misery or fear, anxiety, boredom, despair, whatever, it is the way it is. But and then the acceptance of the way it is allows you to see its changingness. So it's not saying the way it is and then grasping the idea of this is the way it is, that life is suffering and that's the way it is, and then grasping the idea. That's not it. It's not a kind of, a negation of life as that we believe in. But we notice that despair or fear or what is boredom or confusion, whatever, is like this. Not knowing, being uncertain is like this. And so the certainty is in the knowing, isn't it? In this awareness. That's the constant factor in all experience as the conditions change. So this is what we know, bhajjitang veti dapo vinyuhi. So it's not a matter of you having to sort it out according to which Ajahn is right or which has the right method or that. We're not asked to do that, to try to figure out what somebody else is doing, because what we're encouraged to recognize is the way it is in terms of as we experience life. So this evening is, I think at 10 o'clock, we can meet to pay our respect to the stupa, wear your wellies, wellies now become allowable for monastics. But not in the temple. But it's really boggy out there. I tried to go for a walk yesterday. And wade through a bog right out in the on the field. So we can have a break now and then come back, meet here at 10 o'clock.